I'm just going to introduce all of you to Spike Bucklow, and it's a delight to have him here today. He's the director of research at the Hamilton Carr Institute in Cambridge, which is, of course, one of the world's leading centers for teaching and research in the conservation of painting. I should add that the HKI also offers postgraduate diplomas in conservation of easel painting. So if anyone's curious in a career change, that would be a wonderful one. Spike has a wide-ranging interest in the artistic practice of painting, pigment recipes, and various execution techniques, with an expertise that spans the Middle Ages through 17th century Dutch still life and beyond. That is to say, he has extraordinary insight into the science of art. He has produced groundbreaking studies of the Westminster Redible, which is a stunning object which will hopefully be on display soon in the new Westminster Galleries. I'm just going to pull up his PowerPoint here. In addition to that, he's also produced the kind of the key study of the Thornham Parva altarpiece, which belonged to Thetford Priory, the Dominicans. You can see part of it in the Cluny Museum and the other part in Thornham Parva itself. A host of East Anglian rood screens and the delightful Macclesfield Psalter, currently preserved at the Fitzwilliam Museum. His 2009 book, which I adore, called The Alchemy of Paint, takes the reader through a fascinating history of color from lapis lazuli to dragon's blood, wherein the chapters are divided into different hues, bringing pre-modern people and their pigments back to life. In 2014, he published The Riddle of the Image, The Secret Science of Medieval Art, which explores artistic methods and materials employed for a number of case studies, including the Wilton Diptych, I believe. And The Riddle of the Image won the Mercer's International Book Award in 2015. So I'm delighted to introduce Spike Bucklow today, whose unique and informed perspective as a conservator, art historian, and scientist will certainly help to illuminate new ways for us to teach the Codex. Welcome, Spike.
Well, thank you very much. So I want to talk about materiality of codex, and I mean, it follows very nicely from Kate's talk in terms of dealing with images, because we've got a lot of images these days. And what's lost by the digitization of things is their materiality. And insight into materiality depends on science pointing a machine at something and then coming up with an identity of a material. We're very lucky that now machines used to be pointed at manuscripts or paintings and come up with a wiggly line that you then had to interpret and put in context. Now you point machines and they give you images, which is a much easier thing to deal with. This is an infrared image of that. Infrared is a very old, relatively old, method of looking at works of art, and it allows you to see through paint layers to what's underneath the paint layers. So it's used for looking at underdrawing and notations. But here, what I draw your attention to is the blue of the clock and the blue of the demon. They look the same in colour, but one of them goes black and the other one doesn't. So they're actually made out of different materials, and you can use this kind of thing to work out how they have been made. This is an X-ray. X-rays are even older ways of looking at objects, but this time you see what is on the verso. So can you see where the clock is? There's some bird that's coming through from the other side of the parchment. These machines are getting even cleverer. It doesn't show up particularly well on PowerPoint, but these are two colours. The kind of hideous magenta is the presence of cobalt, and the blue that you can hardly see is the presence of aluminium, and that shows that these two blues are again different. The blue that is being used behind the initials is smalt, and the blue that is used for the Virgin's robe is ultramarine. Ultramarine costs probably 20 times as much as smalt, and what's interesting is that this manuscript comes from Venice, and smalt is a ground glass, so this is the oldest example of which I know, where a substitute for lapis is being used. And it shows my interest in this is not the dry nature of the identity of the material. It is trying to enliven the manuscript by giving an idea of the trade and connections that people had. So this is obviously painters or illuminators talking to glassmakers. The trouble with all of those images is that they're made by machines which are quite rare. And whilst science presents itself as producing objective data, that is a work of fiction, actually there's an awful lot of interpretation that is required of that data. So there is a high level of connoisseurship in trying to read scientific data. And connoisseurship, you all know, is dependent upon the breadth of experience you have of comparative data. So if you only have a few machines making a few images, actually they're not nearly as impressive as they look. So I'm going to spend the rest of the time looking at things that you can just see with your naked eye. And I hope you'll have worked out here something. This is Auerbach's page 222 from Mimesis. The most interesting thing in that whole book, as far as I'm concerned, is that one of those lines of print is the wrong way up. And that tells you something about the way this book was assembled. Here, this is not quite so obvious, but in fact it's exactly the same thing. And this is about getting your eye in, which I shouldn't be talking about to you. And it's quite difficult to get your eye into anomalies when there are many other anomalies around. So it's easier to see the fault here in a boring PowerPoint slide than it is one of the ends has been put in upside down. And it's interesting in terms of how your eye adapts to looking at things and extracting information from them. Now I want to show how superficial I am and just look at the pretty pictures here. This is you can see it's a flower. And when I look at illuminations, I will be looking at things that are incredibly simple, just like which colour went on first. With this flower, the black outline went on first, and you can see that because the white overlaps it. I haven't got a pointy thing. Oh, maybe I do. Oh, good, yes. It's not so easy to see here, but take my word for it, that's the failure of PowerPoint. The blue goes over the black here, so that goes on second. That goes on second. This dark one goes on third. This is fourth, and so you can get an idea of the way in which something is constructed. What is of interest to me here, though, with this missile, is the relationship with what's on the other side of the page. So this has transferred itself across here, and it's unusual, we can see in the guttering, it's simpler to see what has transferred. Actually, what's transferred is this white paint has turned that black. Now, this is very unusual. It's unrepresentative. But what's interesting about mistakes is mistakes will illuminate process. And what this is about is not standard transfer of materials. To focus on this up here. That's a blow-up of that, and I think it's page 173. So yeah, that's 172, so that's transferred across. But then if we go to 171, that whatever was transferred has eaten through, and that's 170, that's transferred across, that's eaten through. And this is a very aggressive chemical. It's absolutely dead simple pigment, it's lead white, it's absolutely standard. And that wouldn't have been evident to the makers of the book, it's only become evident over time. But it is due to a stray chemical in the white pigment that shouldn't be there. And it shows that somebody, whoever was making that pigment, was doing alchemical experiments that went slightly wrong. In fact, you can see that the before binding, there were just leaves were sitting on top of each other and moved slightly. And so this is not only very aggressive in terms of eating its way through three or four layers of parchment, it's also very quick. Again, that wouldn't have been visible, but an invisible chemical has seeped into parchment where it shouldn't have been. And then over decades or maybe even centuries, it's become visible. Now, those are that shows the relationship between the illuminator and an alchemist. It may even be the same person. It wasn't intended, but these unintentional things are usually quite useful for understanding process. So this is an underdrawing for marginalia, and this is the unintended process here is the patron died, and so work stopped. But work stopped in a way that allows one to see the creation of the manuscript. So we can see that backgrounds were put in, drapery painted. The previous one shows all of the script was done first, and then there was marking out of the illuminations, and then a kind of block-wise building up of the illumination in a... I mean, it looks better on my screen, I must admit, than that screen. By looking at all of these illuminations, you can see the method of work, because Nigel Morgan has said, and I take his word for it, that this is the work of one hand. So we're seeing a consistent studio practice frozen in time because of the death of the patron. And I don't want to sound like I'm fixated on blues, but we've got three blues here in the background, in the robe, and here in a border. And because of the way in which this illuminator has essentially stopped work, we can see the sequence in which they worked. And individual layers are evident where they should ordinarily, if finished, have been not so evident. So this is a decoration, and it's a completely different manuscript from the one that I showed you, the flower. This is the Metz Pontifical 1330s in the Fitzwilliam Museum. And the pale blue that I showed you in this pale blue here, that pale blue is, well, first thing is the gilding is put on, then this black line is put on, then all of the pale, all of that area is pale blue, and then there's dark blue just roughly put in here, and then the white is added. And what's quite nice is that the pale blue is cheap, low-grade material that you can't use in any other context in making the rich blue of the background. And this blue here that's put on top is very expensive lapis, so you don't want to use a lot of it. So if you have a very thin wash of it, you can use the cheap blue from underneath. And then by leaving a rough area here around where you're going to decorate with white, it makes that white look like it's glowing neon. And that's the, again, this is wonderful when you see the object. PowerPoint is a pale imitation of it. But that kind of neon white glowing is a combination of using up the rubbish that's produced in one pigment preparation and then half covering it with an expensive material. Now, you probably all know this allusion to the universe being a book, whilst the codex is the tree trunk, the leaves are substance and accidents and their relations. And the expense of the book is due to what those substances are, the accidents that they were valued for. and their relations are what I like to study. And they are things like relationships between trades, relationships between countries in terms of import, and intellectual endeavours like alchemy and painting. So thank you very much.